Okay, good morning, everybody. I hope everybody had an enjoyable July the 4th holiday. And my experience is once July 4th comes, the summer flies by. Anyway, there's a bunch of stuff to go over this morning, so let me start right in. First of all, just so that you know, the Equal Employment Opportunity Commission has further extended the deadline for those of you who have to complete EEO-1 reports for 2020 and 2021. The prior deadline was July the 19th. They've now extended that to Monday, August the 23rd. So, a little breathing room for those of you who haven't completed the EEO-1 forms yet. Again, if you are a private sector employer with 100 or more employees, you need to fill these out. Or if you're a company with 50 or more employees and you're a federal prime or first-tier subcontractor and have a contract or purchase order of at least $50,000, then you also have to complete one of these. So again, the new date, Monday, August 23rd, 2021. There have been some reported problems with getting into the EEOC portal. You may want to try that prior to the time that your reports are due. All right. This was in the news a couple of weeks ago locally. It has to do with a former employee of Legg Mason who claimed that she was incorrectly classified as a temporary employee as opposed to a regular employee entitled to benefits. It's an interesting kind of scenario, and I wanted to bring it to your attention because some of you out there may actually utilize temporary employees from time to time, and I think you have to be careful about it. What happened in this case was that a former Legg Mason project manager claimed that for a period of almost 3 years, the company improperly denied her and other similarly situated employees retirement, health, and other benefits by mischaracterizing them as temporary employees as opposed to regular employees. In fact, this plaintiff, her name was Belinda Barbieri, worked at the Legg Mason's Stamford, Connecticut office from February 2017 to August 2020. She's filed a suit in the United States District Court for the Southern District of New York on June 11th. And as you know, Legg Mason used to be headquartered in Baltimore until it was acquired last July of 2020, by Franklin Templeton. So she claims that in addition to being denied employment benefits, that other employees were incorrectly classified as temporary employees and didn't receive severance benefits when they were let go following the closure of the deal with Franklin Templeton. Interestingly enough, she alleges, now remember, these are allegations in the lawsuit, not necessarily facts at this time. She alleges that she was labeled a project manager, worked on highly confidential matters, and she says that she was treated as a full-time employment in that she had permanent office space, had a nameplate on her office, and that she tracked her time and expenses into the regular Legg Mason payroll system. And so the basis of the lawsuit, of course, is under ERISA, saying that she and others should have been entitled to the same benefits that regular employees were entitled to. I bring this up because if you're using temporary employees, it's useful to clarify at the outset with such employees what the term of that temporary employment will be. Obviously, if it's indefinite, the more it begins to look like non-temporary employment in terms of regular employment. And if you provide the indicia of benefits or indicia of sort of regular employment status, such as a regular office, regular hours, etc., it begins to look like the employment is anything but temporary, and it looks like regular employment as well. And if you exclude such employees from benefits, There could be exposure under ERISA and other regulations should you get rid of this person at some point in the future. So it's best to have a writing which stipulates that the person is a temporary employee not entitled to normal employee benefits, that there will be a term of the temporary employment which may be extended by mutual agreement in the future. In other words, document it so that there's no doubt that the person coming in knows that he or she is a temporary employee and not a regular employee entitled to the regular indicia of regular employment and benefits. Along those same lines, and I think that I've spoken about this before in prior telebriefs, you want to make sure that if there's a claim of dual employment with one of your vendors, that that real employer is responsible for any employment-related claim and not you. So, for instance, if you use outside vendors for work like security or janitorial service or IT, where the vendor's employees are going to be on your site for some period of time performing services, and where you have some supervisory responsibilities over these particular employees, you want to have a writing, an agreement with that outside vendor, which stipulates that if there are employment-related claims in which you are alleged to be a dual employer along with that particular vendor, that that vendor is responsible for any employment-related liability, will have defense obligations and indemnification obligations, meaning they will take over the defense of any employment-related claim and be responsible for any employment-related liability. You may even want to go so far as to mandate, if you're dealing with one of these vendors, that they have responsibility to carry appropriate and applicable EPLI, that's Employment Practices Liability Insurance, to cover any employment-related claim. So keep an eye out as we go forward under the Biden administration. I'm sure there's going to be a liberalization of what constitutes dual employment anyway. And so in order to protect yourself against these kinds of claims, have your relationship reduced to writing in an agreement and make sure the appropriate provisions are in there to insulate you from any kind of further liability. And if you have any questions, certainly reach out, be happy to help you with that. Okay, as you most of you know, on June the 15th of 2020, the Supreme Court issued a fairly landmark decision in Bostock versus Clayton County, holding that the prohibitions in Title VII against sex discrimination under the Civil Rights Act of 1964 includes those actions or employment discrimination based on sexual orientation or transgender status. It was a very landmark decision, again, June of 2020. Well, kind of ironically, on the one, or maybe not so coincidentally, on the one-year anniversary of the Bostock decision, June 15th, a couple weeks ago of 2021, and in the middle of Pride Month, the EEOC opened on its website a new hub for educating employers and employees alike on their respective rights and responsibilities regarding sexual orientation and gender identity. The acronym that the EEOC uses is capital S, capital O, capital G, capital I, obviously intending to mean sexual orientation and gender identity. I'm not sure how they pronounce it, whether it's SOGI or SOGI, I don't know. But it's a landing page on their website, and it's got a lot of information on the peripheral issues associated with sexual orientation and gender identity. It also has what's called the EEOC's Technical Assistance Document, entitled Protections Against Employment Discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identity. So it indicates that protection is afforded to job applicants, current employees, and even former employees, regardless of citizenship or immigration status, if their employer has 15 or more employees. The protections apply, as stated, irrespective of whether there are contradictory state or local laws. And in terms of the specific employment actions which are prohibited, let me review those quickly as stated on the website. So they say Title VII protects against discrimination based on sexual orientation and gender identity with respect to general employment practices, including but not limited to hiring, termination, compensation, and other actions. Two, employers may not discriminate because an individual's behavior or apparel, meaning what they wear on the job, does not conform to the stereotypical behavior or apparel or clothing for the individual's sex assigned at birth. This applies whether or not the employer has knowledge of the individual's sexual orientation or gender identity. Three, continued or intentional misuse of preferred pronouns could rise to the level of harassment if it becomes sufficiently severe or pervasive. Importantly, they indicate that an occasional or inadvertent misuse of a pronoun will not lead to liability. This is sort of like sexual harassment where there's a continued course of conduct. Fourth, an employer may not justify discrimination based on customer or client preferences. And last, and importantly, although an employer may have separate sex-segregated bathrooms or locker rooms and showers, the EEOC takes the position that employees may not be denied access to the facilities that correspond to their gender identity. So in other words, under this guidance, if you as an employer have traditional male or female locker rooms or restrooms and even a unisex locker room or probably restroom, you cannot compel somebody to use a bathroom or a locker room where there is other than their own sexual orientation or identity which is being challenged. So they have the right to use that locker room or bathroom, which corresponds to their own identity or their transgendered status. Also, they make clear that customer or client preference cannot justify any kind of discrimination based on sexual orientation or gender identification. So it's a comprehensive landing point on their website. I encourage you to go on it. And I think that there's a lot of practical guidance on that for both employers and employees. So again, it's a pretty comprehensive explanation. I invite you to go on their website. Let me address the issue of telework as an accommodation, permanent accommodation to employees. As you know, coming out of COVID, there are those employees who may request permanent telework. And whether that is a reasonable accommodation or not really is determined on a case-by-case basis. And as always, what you have to do is you need to engage in an interactive dialogue with that employee and determine whether it would be a reasonable accommodation or not to permit that employee to essentially work from home on a permanent basis. Sometimes that could be accommodated, sometimes it can't. Depends on the nature of the particular job. So for instance, if The employee is in a classification where it's a front office and you need the appearance of that employee, it may not be possible to accommodate that telework accommodation. On the other hand, if it's a back office kind of work, it also may mean that either on a hybrid basis or on a permanent basis, accommodation could be done for that particular employee. It really, I think, militates in favor of going back, looking at your job descriptions, which existed probably prior to COVID, and making any kinds of adjustments that are necessary in order to accommodate an employee or not, depending on what the essential functions are stated in your job description. So, as I always say, it's a good time now coming out of COVID to take a good look at your job descriptions and to ascertain whether physical appearance on the job is an essential function of the particular position, and the statement in your job description should reflect whether that's reasonable or not. Okay, for those of you who have employees in Virginia, I want to make reference to a new law which took effect on July the 1st of this year, where Virginia employers with at least 5 employees must make reasonable accommodations to known limitations related to disabilities. And what the new law says is that if you have more than 5 employees, you must have statements in your handbooks that include information about employees' right to reasonable accommodation for disabilities. You must post that information in a conspicuous location. And employers who are covered must provide information about the new law to new employees as well as to any employee who discloses that they have a disability within 10 days of disclosure. Those of you who have employees in Virginia probably have these statements in your handbooks anyway. But I point to you that since this is a new law taking effect July the 1st, that you should have these statements in your handbook, and when someone provides information or a request for a disability accommodation, you have to give information to that employee within 10 days of that particular disclosure. This law was modeled on the Virginia Pregnancy Accommodation Law, which took effect on July 1st of 2020, where Virginia employers have to have those statements regarding pregnancy accommodation in their handbooks, and also similar disclosures and providing information to employees within 10 days after receiving notice of a request for any kind of pregnancy disclosure. Let me talk about another particular kind of trend, and I've mentioned this many times in the past, but again, this is coming up more and more, which has to do with non-compete, non-solicitation agreements. As I always say, for those of you out there who make use of these kinds of post-termination restrictions, there's nothing wrong with confidentiality agreements. They will be given deference by courts, but when it comes to other kinds of post-termination restrictions, I continue to make recommendations to focus on non-solicitation of customers and employees as opposed to strict non-competition agreements, which would, in effect, prevent your departing employee from working for a competitor. It's clear to me where the winds are blowing, and you'll be much better if you focus in on these attempts to restrict employees from soliciting customers and employees as opposed to preventing them from making a living. Finally, let me just make reference to a case decided in late May by the Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, having to do with the Americans with Disability Act and the essentially the concept that they will not, courts will not require an accommodation to be made to an employee whose misconduct is manifested in the workplace and who nevertheless sues under a disability theory that they weren't accommodated. So in this case of Todd versus Fayette County School District, the school district chose not to renew the contract of a teacher who suffered from a major depressive order based on her alleged threats to kill herself and her son, her alleged threats against school administrators, and her alleged overuse of Xanax while at school. She sued the school district, claiming, among other things, that it discriminated against her based on her disability. What the 11th Circuit found was that her contract was appropriately terminated based on her misconduct, that is, the threats against herself and others. The 11th Circuit noted that the school district had even sought to determine whether it could maintain protocols to prevent the teacher from engaging in similar behavior upon returning to work, although it just could not be done. Thus, the 11th Circuit concluded that the ADA, importantly, does not, and I'll quote, require that employers countenance dangerous misconduct, even if that misconduct is the result of a disability. And I would go further and state that the 11th Circuit's decision is really in parallel and in keeping with the decisions of most other courts of appeal, including the 4th Circuit, where we sit. And it's important for you to realize that if an employee is engaged in misconduct, irrespective of the fact that that misconduct may be the manifestation of a particular disability, there is no justification for that misconduct and no obligation on the part of an employer to accommodate anything related to that misconduct, even if it's related to a particular disability. All right. Those are the developments for the day. Lauren, can you take this off of mute? All right. As usual, I'm happy to answer any questions anybody may have. Any questions out there? Okay. Well, if there are no questions, that means everybody was listening and absorbed it, or nobody was listening. Not sure, but hope everybody was listening. All right. We will see each other, at least on a virtual basis, the first Wednesday in July. And thank you, everybody, for participating.
Thank you, Howard.
Take care.
Thank you, Howard.
Thank you.